rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Wheelock, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for the last day of July, July 31, 2024. We do have three oral matters on our calendar today, one non-oral matter. The first matter is file A231948, Jeremy McNitt, the relator, Minnesota IT Services as respondent. And counsel, just a couple preliminary comments. You'll notice, of course, the clock on the podium as usual, so keep an eye on that for purposes of your time. We are recording these proceedings as well as live streaming. No other recording is allowed, but we do, it will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. We do ask counsel if you would identify yourself for the record and who you represent when you begin. And with those comments, counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin when ready.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Cassandra Wolfgram, and I'm here on behalf of Jeremy McNitt. The law repeatedly cited by this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court is, where an agency has no authority to act, action cannot be made effective by equitable principles. Jurisdiction is purely a matter of statute, and that is the issue today. Minnesota IT Services has decided that it is not bound by this law, that it can establish jurisdiction when none exists. And if it doesn't have jurisdiction, it will just make it up. In fact, it went as far as to say that the well-established law is simply dicta. We're here today on two issues: jurisdiction, which Minnesota IT Services did not have, and abuse of discretion, in where they issued a decision contrary to facts, contrary to law, and with the sole purpose of getting the response and result that it wanted.
Counsel, could I inquire? Both parties spend a lot of time in their brief about which of the three, let's say, orders is the proper order for us to review. So we have the ALJ's decision, we have the June decision, and the November decision, and then also spend a lot of time, of course, discussing the SIRS case and its impact on either the June or November orders and or the ALJ's opinion or recommendation, I should say. But really, isn't what the heart of the matter issue before is what you've identified, I believe, in part two of your brief, and I saw it in part four of the respondent's brief, the legal issue of whether an agency has sole discretion under the Criminal Offender Rehabilitation Act, or CORA as we've been identifying it, to make a determination that rehabilitation has not occurred, notwithstanding the documents that are submitted by an applicant. Isn't that the heart of the dispute? I saw it referenced in the ALJ's decision. It was referenced in the remand order of June, and of course it's referenced in the conclusion of the commissioner in November. So isn't that really the heart of the dispute the parties have? And if that's true, what would you say is the strongest argument that you have on behalf of your client that they do not have that sole discretion pursuant to that statute? Which, by the way, I assume you agree is unambiguous.
I agree that it's unambiguous. But I disagree that that's the heart of this issue, because before we can get to that, we have to get to the jurisdiction issue. And the jurisdiction issue in the Sears case, Trinity case, I've always called it Trinity, is that once that ALJ issues a recommendation, the commissioner has to issue a final decision within 90 days.
Let me just interrupt. Yep. I understand that, and obviously it's a It's a winning one if we agree with you, because then the ALJ's decision has made the determination that the commissioner exceeded its authority, the agency did, in denying the application. So I want to kind of jump to that. We can come back to your point about the 90 days.
Jumping to the actual statute of CORA, it does not provide discretion under Subdivision 3. Now, there are two different subdivisions. Subdivision 1, which is where it relates to the employment, we have not appealed that, and we do not dispute or argue that there is no discretion on Subdivision 1. It's Subdivision 3 we are under today, and this provides a mandate. It provides that if the applicant produces competent evidence of sufficient rehabilitation and present fitness, the applicant is not disqualified. It does not provide the agency with any ability to weigh that evidence. It does not provide the agency with any ability to rebut that evidence. If the applicant produces it, they are not disqualified. And that removes any discretion that the agency has.
Counsel, doesn't the fact finder have to determine whether the evidence is in fact competent and whether the rehabilitation is sufficient? Isn't that where we find discretion in the statutory language?
There is no facts in this case that it's not competent or it's not sufficient. And I have cited to the Jacobson case, and there are other cases talking about the presumption. Because what this is it's a presumption by the law. And in that, to beat the presumption, all you have to do is have any evidence that would rebut it. And we have more than that. We have presented the discharge order. He's been free from probation. He has had no criminal offenses. And in Shelton, the Minnesota courts established and discussed that this statute provides that if you go 1 year without criminal convictions, you have established your rehabilitation. And that's what is being ignored in this case. It's not just even that only one of these items in 36403 have been met. It's every single item has been met there. And so under this statute, you present it, the agency has to accept it. They don't have discretion. It doesn't provide them discretion. Otherwise, it would say that the agency could weigh this evidence. The agency could have a hearing as to determine whether or not they think it's competent. But it doesn't. It just says if the applicant produces it, they shall not be disqualified.
Counsel, is that why both parties before the ALJ believe there was no issues, we'll use the civil summary judgment, the summary disposition, material fact. Is that the reason why the parties did it? Seemed like there, like I say, every step of the way, it's been the legal question, the legal issue of what discretion does the agency have to determine rehabilitation. That seemed to be the issue before the ALJ, and again, it continues on. Is that the reason both the agency and your client did not request an evidentiary hearing with live witnesses?
Correct. There was no issue as to what was presented to the agency. There was no dispute as to what they considered. They considered the list of information that they requested and which was produced by Mr. McNitt and is in the addendum at 83 through 89. They considered all of that. That's what they considered. That's what they used. But they just ignored it. And so they're just saying that we can ignore everything and avoid application of the statute. Well, under this argument that they have discretion, the statute's meaningless. The statute has no purpose, and it would just be a waste. Because
what would be an example, to follow up Judge Wheelock's question, though, obviously the phrase competent evidence is used. What would be an example, then, where a document is submitted consistent with that statute, but it wasn't competent?
Your Honor, we would go back to, there's very few cases on this actual statute. There's Shelton and Peterson, which are the most, really the only cases on it. And Shelton, they discussed that all he did was come in and didn't even prove that there had been a year since his conviction. And it's the same in Peterson, that there was not a year since the conviction, there was no evidence that he was discharged from probation, and there was no other evidence under 3B of mitigating factors or other supporting evidence such as the circumstances length of time that could support rehabilitation. So in those situations, there was nothing. They didn't meet any of the standards, any of the documentary proof here. And the court said that it was not unreasonable to ignore when one of the applicants had contradictory sworn declarations, that can't be considered competent.
So is it your belief, the way it's written, the legislature intended, for example, that if one has been successfully discharged on probation, then it's ipso facto rehabilitation?
Well, that's what the court stated in Shelton, is that if 1 year has elapsed since release of incarceration without subsequent conviction of another crime, that is demonstration of sufficient rehabilitation. And that's included directly in Shelton, and that's what Shelton and Peterson did not have. They didn't have that 1 year.
Does that vary by the underlying offense, though?
It does not. That's just specifically in Subdivision 3.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, there is an exception statute, which is not at play in this case, and that is Section 364.09. And so there are certain offenses that fall under that exception statute, and so those are not subject to CORA. And there are also certain employments that are not subject to CORA. And so the legislature said there are certain crimes that we find should not be in this CORA, and you should not have this presumption. But there are everything else that's not included in 364.09 is subject to CORA, and it's subject to that 1 year requirement that you go 1 year without a subsequent conviction, you are presumed to be rehabilitated.
I'm still not persuaded that we should not read the qualifiers. It says competent evidence, not any evidence. It says sufficient rehabilitation, not some rehabilitation. And when we look at the items that can be submitted and considered under Subdivision 3B, I guess I'm wondering whether it's also then your position that the court cannot make any type of credibility determinations the agency, when it receives that information.
That is our understanding of the statute, Your Honor. It's very specific that if you present it and it's competent, then it has to be used and it cannot just be thrown to the wayside. Now, going back to Peterson, which was the license case, he had contradictory sworn statements. And so in that situation, there was a reason to doubt them, and it was presented by the applicant. And that's another important part of the statute, is it's only information submitted by the applicant. It does not say that the agency can use any outside information. It does not say that they can do their own investigation. It says if the applicant produces this information, and that the agency can only consider what is produced by the applicant under any of these situations. Now, the big thing in this is we don't even just have one of these met. We have every single category under here. And so according to the agency, they can ignore every single category, making the statute entirely superfluous, because Mr. McNitt has a conviction of a crime. The agency comes back and says, well, because you have a conviction, we are disqualifying you. Mr. McNitt comes and says, here is all my evidence of my sufficient rehabilitation and present fitness. I have not had a conviction in years. I've only had one in 2017. I was released early from probation. I have completed all my terms and conditions. I've gone 1 year since I was discharged. The agency comes back and says, well, we don't like the facts of your crime, so we're saying you're disqualified. So in other words, he does everything, and the agency says, because you have a conviction, you are disqualified. That is the opposite of what this statute says. And under their interpretation, no individual would be capable of meeting it. If Mr. McNitt, who meets every single category, cannot prove fitness and rehabilitation, showing this, then who can? No one. Because the agency says, we are ignoring the present fitness and rehabilitation and saying the conviction disqualifies you contrary to law.
Well, the factors that are listed under B are things such as the nature and seriousness of the crime or crimes for which convicted, the age of the person at the time the crimes were committed, the length of time elapsed. And I'm just wondering, it seems to me that those are factors that, if depending on the information that's provided, are different, that the agency should be able to consider those and make a different determination for someone, for example, who might have a more serious crime. And perhaps it was not that long ago versus someone who committed a less serious crime and it was many, many years prior to the time that they apply.
Well, it goes back to Shelton and Peterson, which went back into this that there are two sections. There is the 1 year since you've been discharged from probation, or the 1 year since conviction of the crime, and there is also the other mitigating factors. And Shelton describes it as these mitigating factors and other circumstances. So if you haven't met that 1 year, you haven't been discharged, you can present these mitigating factors and circumstances for the agency to consider that you are actually rehabilitated and presently fit. But it doesn't say in the statute that the agency can use the facts of the crime against rehabilitation and present fitness. It says in subdivision one, they can use the facts of the crime to determine whether the conviction is related. And that's the first step, because that is what goes to disqualification. But subdivision three is evidence of rehabilitation. It is not evidence against rehabilitation. It is not weighing evidence of rehabilitation and present fitness. It is evidence of rehabilitation. What can be used to consider and determine that the applicant is not disqualified, that they have met that presumption, that they have rebutted the presumption of disqualification and are entitled to employment.
Counsel, though, is when you have an underlying crime like possession of child pornography, it suggests that your sexual preference is children, and we don't rehabilitate from that. I mean, you're not going to rehabilitate a heterosexual into being something that he or she isn't, and you're not going to rehabilitate a homosexual into being something that he or she isn't. Why would you be able to rehabilitate a person whose sexual preference is children?
Your Honor, if the legislature...
Yes, that's what I was going to say. Thank you.
Your Honor, if the legislature intended for this type of crime to be excluded from CORA, it would have been listed in 364.09 along with other types of crimes. So they have, like, assaults listed. They did not include this type of crime. So they indicate that they believe, as is the mandate and the purpose of CORA, that this is a rehabilitated crime that can be rehabilitated, and by completing probation and not having subsequent crimes, Mr. McNitt has met his burden.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes to rebuttal. Counsel will respond. When you're ready, you may approach, identify yourself, and begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Amanda Prutzman. I'm representing Minnesota IT Services, or MINIT. MINIT is an executive agency that partners with other executive agencies to provide IT services according to their needs. One of the ways MINIT does this is by providing employees that it hires to work on projects for other agencies. We are here because Relator applied for one of MINIT's positions to work with the Department of Education. And Minnett discovered in his background check that he was convicted of felony possession of child abuse material, child pornography. And it's relevant that this position would allow Relator to have access to sensitive information on minors, children, throughout the state of Minnesota. This case presents two issues. One is the Trinity issue, but really, as Judge Slater said, the heart of it is the CORA issue and whether or not an agency has discretion to consider whether or not an applicant is sufficiently rehabilitated and presently fit. One thing that I think is very important to note is in arguing that CORA presents an irrebuttable presumption of sufficient rehabilitation, relator consistently leaves out the next part, the very next important phrase in the statute, which is to perform the duties of the public employment sought or the occupation for which the license is sought.
But that, Council, can I ask about that?
Yes.
In subdivision 2, the legislature is pretty clear in giving explicit discretion, it seems, to the employer, so in this case the agency, to make a determination, and that would be based on the facts of the crime for which one's convicted, that will have a directly impact, or I can't remember the phrase, the employment. But we don't have similar language in subdivision 3, and so it strikes me that and Council made a good point, and here the commissioner looked at all the facts under subdivision 3 too, but we already have the crime, and then we have a purpose in the statute that one's rehabilitated, and then we have a list of items that may establish that the phrase is a substantial, sufficient rehabilitation, competent evidence. So what specific language in subdivision 3, you agree it's unambiguous, that you say directs the agency to have the discretion, and I think it's the commissioner's phrase, sole discretion, not even the in this case, there'd be a fact finder, although no facts were found. Obviously, it was summary judgment. But that's my understanding of the position, that even if a ALJ, an independent fact finder, said a person's been rehabilitated, the agency believes, nope, we can disagree with that. So where in subdivision 3 would you direct us to find that discretion?
Many places, Your Honor. All right. So subdivision 3. First, as Your Honor correctly noted, subdivision 2 does provide for discretion. And one of the ways that it does that is it says the hiring or license authority shall consider the nature and seriousness of the crimes, etc. If you look at subdivision 3B, it says, in addition to the documentary evidence provided, that's obviously referring to 3A, because 3A is a DD-214 discharge order, completion of probation, release orders, things of that nature, which are documentary. The licensing authority shall consider any evidence presented by the applicant regarding, and then it lists 5 more things. And so clearly 3B is discretionary. In fact, relator argued in his exceptions to the commissioner that 3B is
discretionary. But discretionary, where does it say who has the discretion? That's my question.
Well, the discretion would be to the public employer, and it would necessarily need to be there because as
Judge Kirk- Where do we find that in the language that the discretion is with the employer pursuant to either A or B?
In either A or B, the hiring authority shall consider, and shall consider means an shall consider modifies the hiring authority, so it means the hiring authority shall consider
discretion. Yeah, consider the competent evidence, but then the statute says competent evidence is established and then gives a list of how it's established.
Correct.
And it says relator points out, all of these were submitted.
Yes. The evidence was submitted. The statute says may be established. And as a matter of law, may is permissive.
But would you agree that depends on the context of where may is used? So if it had said the agency may have the discretion, which I don't know that would be an understandable phrase, but here it's in the middle of that paragraph A, which beginning to list the items. So for instance, the first one, and I'm assuming this is because it was right near at the end of the Vietnam War, the very first one listed is a United States Department of Defense DD-214 form. So, for instance, are you telling me that just jumps right out, that someone submits that, they still are not rehabilitated at the discretion of the agency?
Right. It may, a DD-214 form may establish sufficient rehabilitation. It may not. It is important to note that the legislature originally, when drafting this, had Competent evidence of sufficient rehabilitation shall be established by production of, and then the rest of the statute.
Isn't that just explained by the fact that not everybody will have the specific form, the DD-214, but in fact, one of these other three items that are listed can also establish it? Isn't the may be established just telling us which items that they can look at, and it could be any of them that is provided to establish that rehabilitation has occurred?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Also in conjunction with the ors, or a copy of this order, or a copy of something showing you've completed probation satisfactorily. It can be a combination of these documents, but the may is also permissive. It does not mean that these do conclusively establish sufficient rehabilitation. Another place I would point the court to is section, it's subdivision 3C, I'm sorry, subdivision 3B5. All other competent evidence of rehabilitation and present fitness, including but not limited to. The phrase but not limited to means there could be other things, which again shows that this is a fact-dependent situation, case by case, depending on convictions, depending on the position of employment sought, et cetera. Further, the entirety of the language in 3B here would be superfluous if 3A was an irrebuttable presumption of rehabilitation for any position, for any duties, for any license, in any public employer. And it's important.
Counsel, if I understand the agency's position, that seems to me to almost gut the purpose of this statute. And looking at this commissioner's order, it not only said you're not eligible and then had, I think, reduced it from 10 years to 5 years, and despite all the information provided here and the purpose of the statute, do you believe that this section, this chapter, was intended to be so subjective, left to the, without saying directly, the discretion of an agency to say, despite all of this, and even if a fact finder had heard live testimony, which again didn't happen here, the agency was granted authority by here to say, no, we don't agree?
I think the purpose of this statute was to allow for case-by-case situations based on conviction and duties and employers. And it's important to note that it's not just the state that's affected by this. It's school districts, it's municipalities, it's any public government in the state.
But Relator makes a good point, though. We've got a separate chapter that excludes a lot of types of professions, and I think teaching was listed, if I recall, and there's something to do with education and particular crimes that just aren't involved. So once that obviously means then the rest are eligible, and if one can submit all this information and it's still not eligible, doesn't that, again, gut the purpose under section, I think it was 01 of 364 of this whole Rehabilitation Act?
Couple of reasons it doesn't, Your Honor. Number one, we agree that the language is unambiguous, and if a statute is unambiguous, the plain language of the statute cannot be overridden by the policy. Second of all, the remedy for violations or grievances by a public employer under this statute is submission to a contested case hearing under the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act, Chapter 14. And Chapter 14 allows for presentation of witnesses, cross-examination, discovery, all of these things.
But your point being is, notwithstanding that, the agency can still, the commissioner can say, disagree.
And then the remedy would be for this court to review whether or not the commissioner's order is based on substantial evidence or arbitrary and capricious, or if a remand is necessary under 14.69 as well, Your Honor. One other point that I would like to draw the court's attention to in the statute is 364.05, subdivision 4, which is the part of CORA that requires a public employer to notify an applicant when they're disqualified of five things. And one of those things is, quote, that all competent evidence of rehabilitation presented will be considered upon reapplication. Again, will be considered upon reapplication, so will be considered, continues to show discretion. The Supreme Court has already decided that there's discretion in subsection 3, period. The Peterson case conclusively establishes that there's discretion. The court considered subdivision 2 and subdivision 3 in Peterson, and not just subdivision 2. And the court said, at the third from the last paragraph in Peterson, on page 921, that subdivision 3 is not, it's not a direction. The relator there claimed that the court ignored the directive regarding the time that has elapsed. And the court said, the time that's elapsed since the applicant had committed the crime is only one factor to be considered in view of the evidence as a whole, because there was a presentation of the evidence, and appellant's contradictory sworn statements in presentation of the evidence and in the arguments he made, similar to here. The public employer, the committee, and the council were, quote, clearly not compelled to find that he had proved his rehabilitation and present fitness. And one more thing, the statute is silent on what is present fitness. While the statute says what is what may be sufficient rehabilitation for the duties of the public employment sought, it does not set forth anything for what may be present fitness. So a public employer needs to necessarily determine what present fitness is, because the statute requires both. So for those reasons, and one more thing, Your Honor. Again, we agree it's not ambiguous, but in the event it was ambiguous, we can also consider administrative interpretations of the statute. And it's notable that OAH has consistently, in its opinions, applied CORA to be discretionary, that the public employer can look at the particular facts of the situation.
Is it safe to say, counsel, by the way, procedurally, this was a bit of an odd, because, of course, SIRS comes out after the June order of the commissioner, which did actually remand. And one of the questions I had for you is that because the commissioner felt it wanted live testimony? Is that essentially, because obviously the commissioner ruled that there was genuine issue of material fact. That was one of the rejections, I think, of the legal conclusion. Was that the idea that the commissioner thought it needed to have live testimony to determine rehabilitation?
I think in this case, Your Honor, the commissioner determined that minutes motion, he denied minutes motion, and he denied relator's motion. He rejected timely and conclusively within his authority, rejected the ALJ's conclusion and recommendation that CORA is per se evidence of rehabilitation.
But the one thing, again, getting the main discussion we were having this morning, but it also rejected the idea that the agency did not have the sole discretion. So the commissioner, even if it, again, if it would have gone back and would have had live testimony and their same recommendation would have occurred, the commissioner feels that it has the ability under the statute to say no.
Your Honor, yes, because after there is an evidentiary hearing, the commissioner must make his determination based on the entirety of the record, not just what relator submits. But it is a de novo review after there's an evidentiary hearing.
But again, here, you're basing that authority under subdivision 3 of CORA, of this the statute we're talking about, not just general administrative law that we normally deal with, but today we're dealing with CORA, or this case, kind of unique in that way. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're saying implicitly, unambiguously grants authority to the commissioner to disagree, to be the sole determiner whether rehabilitation has occurred, notwithstanding the documents and notwithstanding an ALJ's fact-finding.
Your Honor, may I briefly respond, because my time has run out. Two things. Number one, CORA explicitly incorporates MAPA into the statute. So it's clear that the commissioner can consider
the grievance process.
Correct.
But I was asking about the discretion authorized by CORA itself, but who makes the determination?
And, Your Honor, can you clarify your question then for me? Because I want to make sure I do respond.
The topic we've been on is it's Commissioner's belief that Subdivision 3 grants authority to the employer to make the determination whether, notwithstanding these documents being submitted, rehabilitation has really occurred.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. I'm sorry for being a bit vague. Counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to briefly go back to the summary disposition and talk a little bit about that and Minnett's interpretation of the statute and going specifically into how unreasonable this interpretation is. According to Minnett, they can disqualify Mr. McNitt even though he submitted competent evidence of sufficient rehabilitation and present fitness, which is his burden at disqualification. Then, because they disqualified him, Mr. McNitt is forced to obtain a hearing under Chapter 14. And now, Minnett argues that he has the burden of proving to a preponderance of the evidence that he has been sufficiently rehabilitated and presently fit. And at this point, they can request discovery to contradict all of his evidence and make him meet that burden even harder. Now, if the commissioner, as he did in this case, just says, I agree that there's evidence, but I'm going to disqualify you anyway because I just want to, then he has to go in appeal where now the burden is abuse of discretion. So every step of the way, because of the commissioner's actions, Mr. McNitt has a higher and higher burden. That isn't what the statute is meant to do. And this is absurd and it's unreasonable that he would have to be proving a higher burden at the administrative level than he did to prove that he is not disqualified. That now he has to not only prove he was not disqualified, but also that the commissioner abused its discretion by ignoring all the evidence that he submitted at this appellate level. And this is just where we are today, is Minnett wants to use the statute not because they followed the rules, not because they have actually complied with it, but because they have a result that they want. Well, the reality is, this result they want is to make this crime a de facto disqualification. They can't do that on their own. They need to use the legislature. That is their remedy. They can go to the legislature and say, this needs to be added to 364.09. They haven't. They could say, technology position should be added to 364.09. They haven't. And this court cannot read words into a statute which are not there. 364.03 does not provide them with discretion to ignore all the evidence. And this is directly contradictory to what the court said in Shelton, which in both Shelton and Peterson, and I fully briefed these, and so I don't want to go into deep detail with my limited time, but in both of those, the applicants had not met 1 year since conviction of the crime. Neither of the applicants had been discharged from probation. And so in Peterson, the court talked about discretion under subdivision 3B, talking about the length of time under 3B because of the fact that he didn't meet any of those under 3A. And they said, considering that and considering his contradictory statements, we cannot say that the 4 years compelled the city council to find that he was rehabilitated. But Shelton also did not present evidence other than the fact that he had just had the conviction. And that's the difference here. And what Minnett is asking this court to ignore is that this has been met. This court has not addressed 3A, which Shelton wrote it out very clearly.
Counsel, can I ask you a practical question? Yep. On the remedy, your client, if we were to agree and reverse, I'm assuming as a practical matter that particular positions have been filled given the time that's gone by and maybe your client's employed elsewhere, but what will the remedy be?
Your Honor, part of that needs to be remanded back, and that's on the basis that it has not actually been addressed by the ALJ or the commissioner because the damages issue was not necessary to the sole issue that Minnett allowed to proceed to the hearing. And I want to make sure that this is clear. Minnett was in charge of what the hearing could be, and they limited it to only whether or not Minnett had violated CORA on this specific position. They didn't allow damages in at that hearing. They also did not allow him to be heard on the fact that he was de facto disqualified from all other positions at Minute. They would not allow him to be considered and would not allow him to seek any judicial relief for that either, saying that by not actually disqualifying him, he didn't have any option, but he was disqualified. And so, Your Honor, those haven't been addressed by the commissioner or the ALJ. And under NorthMet, then it's appropriate to remand those issues because they were not material, and so they do not affect whether the ALJ's recommendation, which this court will have to find is the final decision, covered all the material issues. Your Honor, I am out of time, and so I'd like to thank you and ask that you reverse and remand, as we stated in our brief.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions and your briefing as well. We will take the matter under advisement, issue an opinion within 90 days. You each have a good day.